Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. The name Vanderbilt conjures images of Gilded Age opulence, heiresses, and robber barons and Newport mansions. It also conjures up jeans for those of us a certain age. In her new novel, A Well-Behaved Woman, best-selling author Therese Ann Fowler tells the story of Alva Smith Vanderbilt Belmont, a woman who defied convention, asserted power within her marriage to William K. Vanderbilt, and became a leader in the women's suffragette movement. Described by the author as a kind of homage to Edith Wharton with a dash of affection for Jane Austen for good measure. A Well-Behaved Woman brings us inside the glittering world of enormous wealth contrasted against desperate poverty. A Well-Behaved Woman is published by St. Martin's Press, and Therese Ann Fowler's in studio. Nice to see you.
Glad to be here.
So of all the subjects, of all the interesting women in history you could have focused in on, why Alva Smith?
Oh my gosh. Well, I got interested in the Vanderbilt story originally by learning about the Gloria Vanderbilt custody battle, right, 1934, where Gloria's mother and Gloria's aunt fought over custody of her. And I saw this article, and I was fascinated by that story, and then I wondered, who are these people?
That was the poor little rich girl story, right? Yeah,
exactly, little Gloria. So I started reading a little bit deeper about that, and it was just this rabbit hole of research all the way back to, you know, the Commodore, whose statue stands in front of Grand Central Station. And it's Alva, who marries into the family when the Commodore is sort of still trying to push his family into society. And I think we can credit her with bringing the Vanderbilts into society and sort of creating this dynastic vision of them the way we know them now.
Yeah, I think they're more present here in New York because of Vanderbilt Hall. Because
everything.
Anderson Cooper, who is a Vanderbilt, his
right,
mom is Gloria
right.
Vanderbilt.
That's right.
But it's interesting when you think about, you brought a subject of someone who married in and her role within marrying into that family. She grew up in the South.
She did, right.
What was her income level, to be frank?
Her family was reasonably well off. Her mother's people, as they say in the South, were plantation owners, cotton growers, and had deep roots. Right. And then also supposedly roots in the aristocracy in Scotland and maybe in England. That was the story that Alva got as a girl. And her father had been an attorney, and so not super rich. But, you know, this was a time when well-off families were comfortable. And when Alva and her parents moved to New York City in 1859, they were working, her father was working in the cotton trade, right? So that's the international markets for cotton. Mm-hmm. But the Civil War made it so that it was not a great time for Southerners and cotton in New York City. So he moves the family to Paris, and Alva ends up actually growing up there. So she is Southern born, but she spent all her formative years in Paris and in part of the French court.
Now, as you start researching about Alva and the Vanderbilts, I understand there wasn't quite as much scholarly research about the Vanderbilts as one might think.
That's right. It's really mostly sort of pop culture kinds of references about her. And so it made it really challenging to kind of get to the bottom of things.
How did you do it? Did you go looking for journals? Did you go looking into Vanderbilt libraries to find how? What did you use as your source material?
You have to kind of dig down to the bottom, and when you get to the bottom about Alva in particular, there isn't very much that's authoritative. She had attempted to write a memoir, which was dictated to different secretaries at different times, and neither of those projects ever got finished. And then, really, the only other account that we could consider authoritative came from her daughter's memoir. I don't think there is anything else that we could say is absolutely truthful. And even then, you know, is a memoir absolutely truthful? So you do the best you can do. That's the answer.
It's through a lens. It's the very specific. They always say, write your memoir first so you get it on paper. That was always the Katharine Graham theory. As you're researching and you're looking at the for you know research and literature, how important were pictures to you? That was the first thing I went to look for. I wanted to see what she looked like.
Right, we want to kind of know who are these people.
Yeah,
and Alva, you know, it's worth noting that she was not a great beauty in her later years, right?
No,
but she was quite lovely when she was a young woman, and that kind of gave me a feel for who she was when she, you know, was finding her way into this family. I should note that her family had lost everything at the time. So she marries well because she's desperate and the family is out of money. Her mother's dead. The straits are dire for them. And so it's a practical concern. There's a really famous quote by Alva, which is, you know, marry first for money and marry second for love. And I think she followed her own advice to the T.
So people probably know this, but I'll say it for people who don't know, that Therese Ann Fowler wrote the best-selling novel Z, a novel of Zelda Fitzgerald. How was researching Zelda different than Alva? And did that have a lot to do with the fact with F. Scott Fitzgerald was Zelda's husband?
Right. So there's a terrific amount of scholarship about both of the Fitzgeralds, in part because Scott was who he was. Mm-hmm. And there are two fabulous biographies about Zelda in which someone sort of already did the work that I wish had been done about Alva, where we have the popular conception of who Zelda was, and then we have a deeper, more nuanced explanation of who she probably was. If I'd had that about Alva, I would have saved myself a lot of time. The version that I was working with of her is the one that we all think we know. And then I found out very late in the process that it probably wasn't right.
That's so interesting. In writing a book, I wrote a book, it took a very long time to do. I went back to all of the research I'd done initially mm-hmm. when I got to the end because I knew more.
Right.
And I knew that I thought, you know, I may have missed nuance early on because I just didn't know enough.
Yeah, you take what's there at face value to right. start with. And then I was building that version of the story of that version of Alva's character from that information. And then I realized, wait a minute, the evidence doesn't really match here. This reputation of her as being this pushy, materialistic, self-centered social climber is really not exactly true. It's like the journalists of the time created this image of her. And we have to remember the journalists of the time were men. Mm-hmm. And many of them were men who were just scraping by. We talked about how, you know, it was a time of great poverty and a time of excess in the Gilded Age. And so if you're a journalist watching the goings on of these wealthy families, you know, and this woman who doesn't seem to know her place, mm-hmm. you're not going to talk about her very well.
You mentioned this earlier, and I want to tease it out a little bit, that Alva married strategically.
She did.
It wasn't necessarily for love. How did she encounter William Vanderbilt?
This is sort of the Jane Austen-ish part of the book. It's a marriage plot that her best friend, Consuelo Iznaga, originates. So Consuelo and Alva have been friends since they were children. They were vacationing in Newport together long before the war. And Consuelo, her family has money still.
Interesting family story with Consuelo.
Indeed.
Explain for folks.
And she wants Alva to marry well, and she knows that Alva needs more than just money. So she doesn't want Alva to marry some nouveau riche guy. She wants somebody who's got some roots in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And so the Vanderbilt family turns out to be, you know, the object of Consuelo's aims and therefore Alva's.
And Consuelo was a half-Cuban sugarcane
heiress.
That's
right, yeah.
And she had, did they name their child after her?
They did.
That's right, that's right.
She played the banjo, too.
These are interesting women.
They really are.
We're talking to Therese Ann Fowler about her new book, A Well-Behaved Woman, a novel of the Vanderbilts. And as soon as I saw the title and I started reading the book, I'm like, that reminds me of the bumper sticker in my office, Well-Behaved Women Rarely Make
History.
What
a coincidence.
In terms of your title, I mean, were you hoping to evoke that for people?
Yes. I mean, obviously, if you have that, we have it in culture, right? And that makes the title ironic because we know that Alva really was not terribly well behaved. Ultimately, she tried and failed to behave well according to, you know, the standards of a woman in her class. But I didn't have the title until really late in the project. It went under a whole bunch of really other bad working titles, and we called it V for a long time.
That's great. So wait, what would it mean to be well-behaved during Alva's
in
time?
In her time, basically, you know, spend the money and be quiet. You know, do the things that ladies do. Have your little social circles, you know, go to high tea, raise money for good causes, but definitely don't try to be political. Right. And definitely don't try to step outside of, you know, that domestic sphere. But Alva was fascinated by architecture. And I think if she lived today, she would have, you know, gone on to study architecture and been an architect. But
yeah, clearly a bright woman.
Yeah. But in her time, you know, she was seen as eccentric.
So she meets William Vanderbilt. He inherits $65 million, mm-hmm. which is a lot of money now, but in 1885.
Something like by a factor of 20,
I think.
Can
you imagine that? They were seen as new money, right?
Yeah, the Vanderbilt
What does that
family,
mean exactly at that time?
At that time. So if we kind of use Edith Wharton's New York and the era as our guide, the landed gentry of New York City were people who'd been here, families who'd been here since very early Manhattan settlement. The Vanderbilts came from Staten Island, And it was not until Cornelius Vanderbilt, who we know as the Commodore, comes over that the Vanderbilts are in Manhattan. So he's making money already at this point, but to the existing Manhattanites, the Knickerbockers, it's new money. And so the family thinks that they ought to be accepted into what they called best society. But no, sorry, you didn't have four generations, you know, in Manhattan, so you're not in.
How does that manifest itself in day-to-day living?
I see.
Do you get to, what is it, you're not invited to be in this club, you're not invited to this party?
Yeah, it's there were various social clubs that the men did or did not get to belong to. For the women, it would be, you know, who was invited to which social events and which events were considered most important. So it was really just about the in crowd and the not in crowd, which just, it seems sort of frivolous to us now.
A bit.
But if you think about what women could do in their day, I mean, it was very limited. So if you're a woman who wants to do important things, as Alva was, mm-hmm. you need to be able to be in positions where important things are done.
And close to people who can make important things happen. That's the other
part
of that equation. Therese Ann Fowler's in studio with me. Her new book is called A Well-Behaved Woman, a novel of the Vanderbilts. Alva does something that a well-behaved woman does not do. She wants to get divorced. After she lands this fellow with all the money, she wants to divorce.
That's right. She was ambivalent about this marriage right from the start. But she did the thing that she felt she needed to do, right? Her sisters needed to be taken care of. Her father was an invalid when the marriage took place. So it was a very pragmatic decision.
So in terms of her getting a divorce, was that easy to do? I can't imagine it was.
I can't give away too much of how the machinations occur, but suffice it to say that she was risking everything that she'd spent, 20 years trying to accomplish by making that choice.
As you researched this, did it become clear to you that she always had this idea of being a political player in mind? She later on in her life becomes part of the suffragette movement.
Right.
Was that something that was initially part of her decision to marry this man and work her way up in New York society, or did she have somewhat of an awakening?
No, I think it happened as she got older and she started to recognize as conditions changed, especially for the people who were not of upper classes in New York, she saw a need for women to be able to empower themselves. And there was, this nascent movement for women's suffrage at the time, but there were not very many women of her class involved in it. So this is another way that she sort of breaks through the mold of what she is supposed to be doing by not just giving money, but getting actively involved in that effort. And one of the things that I think also set her apart was she didn't just join the movement. When she got frustrated with the slow pace, she started her own organization with Alice Paul, and she opened up organizations throughout New York City, and she offered, hygiene products to women and job training to women through these organizations. And she was, I think, perhaps the only suffragist of the era to deliberately include African-American women in the attempt to get the vote. So she didn't have to do any of that. She could have just, sat around in her beautiful hats and eaten bonbons or whatever women were eating at the time.
She's very forward-thinking.
She was.
That's really interesting. I read in one interview before I let you go that you feel like she may have been demonized the way that some people characterized Hillary Clinton. What did you mean by that?
Right. So I was talking about the sort of mismatch between the evidence and the reputation. And it was when Hillary Clinton's memoir was published and the press sort of was piling on again, as they had done during the last election cycle, about Hillary. And I remembered how people who worked with her spoke so highly of her as a person, spoke of her warmth and how caring she was and the way she thought about their families and paid attention to the details of their lives. And I realized that there must be some mischaracterization going on. Mm-hmm. The adjectives that are used to describe women who assert themselves or who are in positions of power are very different from the adjectives to describe men who do the same kinds of things. And so I started looking at Alva with different adjectives, and I was like amazed at how differently I saw her. It sort of was the key that unlocked the way to get the book done right.
In your mind, last question.
Yeah.
Who would play Alva in a movie? Who would be an actress so our listeners can sort of visualize who you're thinking?
That's a really great question. The book is actually in development with Sony Pictures TV.
Oh, fantastic.
Right.
Congratulations.
So maybe, you know, we should take a vote with everyone who's listening to say who should play Alva. I don't want to prejudice myself on this. In case the actress who does get the job, you know, hears me say someone else's name.
Oh, okay. let me offer, I'm going to offer Marcia Gay Harden.
She's probably too old for the role.
Too old? No.
I'm
thinking of her.
Yeah, but Alva's only, you know, 21 years old at the beginning of the story. So okay. We need a young woman, someone who's
okay.
a dynamo.
I'm going to think about that. Young woman dynamo. I'm going to put my brain on it. Therese Ann Fowler, thank you so much for joining us in studio.
Delighted to be here.
The name of the book is A Well-Behaved Woman, a novel of the Vanderbilts. You're listening to WNYC. Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. When was the last time you stepped out of your cultural and or political bubble? Would you be brave or tolerant enough to do so? Today, let me introduce you to someone who went for it. RJ Young, a young black PhD candidate and football fan, immersed himself in the world of guns in order to connect with his future father-in-law. He ended up becoming an NRA certified pistol instructor along the way. Young has written for Reuters, The Oklahoman, and USA Today, and he has a YouTube channel and a podcast about Oklahoma Sooners football, about which he is passionate. And he's here to tell us today about his new memoir, Let It Bang, A Young Black Man's Reluctant Odyssey into Guns. RJ, welcome to All of It.
What's good, Allison?
It's all good, man. It's good. So your intimate relationship with gun culture started with your future father-in-law. I want to get to that because that's a really big part of the story. But what had been your experiences with guns before that?
Guns were something other folks had, dude. Like, guns were something that I saw on TV and, you know, in a rap video. Like, I make reference to this in the book when I talk about things like Denzel Washington in Training Day, mm-hmm. Lonzo, you know, he got the Gat. You know, they weren't things that I grew up with, just weren't a big part of my family. So for me to go near guns was also for me to invite danger, and I was not really into that idea.
Well, it's interesting because you talked about family. Part of this was, in a way, it seemed when I was reading it, that Charles was trying to invite you into that family, and guns were the conduit. Did you see it that way initially, or were you just like, whoa, dude, why are you showing me a gun upon meeting you?
Right. Well, it's whoa, dude. But also, remember, I'm in a room not with just Charles, but also with Lizzie and his wife, whom I knew. Mm-hmm. Right. This was my first interaction with Charles. So it wasn't just whoa, dude. It was whoa, dude. And then looking at them to get my P's and Q's and be like, no, their faces were that of, you know, this is a big deal. And this is a genuine gesture of friendship. But also, yo, he's handing me a gun, and it's a Taurus Judge, which to me is like a flaming scimitar. And it was like hot to the touch. And I, you know, also, you're in that moment. You want to impress your girlfriend's father. I don't care who you are, right? So you can't just say, no, I'm not taking it. And at the same time, you want to be reverent and take into account what this moment is. And then ask questions later, right? Stand in that fear and ask questions later.
Did you ever at that moment, did you take it as a threat in any way or threatening in any way? You better be good to my little girl, Lizzie, because I'm a gun owner.
No, I didn't. But that's also because as a black man, I have to read people on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm on Twitter, I'm on YouTube, I'm on the internet. So those places are actually harder for me to understand whether or not somebody's being sarcastic or being genuine. But the thing about Charles is that he was always genuine, or he was always woke to the joke. I always knew where I stood, right? And that was my first moment of understanding that he was being honest about how big a deal this was to him and just what I was supposed to take from it. But no, I never felt threatened in that manner, because he was presenting the gun to me like you would a plaque. Like we talked about, or you talked about, how much I love OU football. So if I had a football that was autographed by Bob Stoops, Jason White, Sam Bradford, Baker Mayfield, I would present it in much the same way.
Right. And I think that a lot of folks who haven't been around people who have guns, they don't really understand. It's cultural. It's like people who go sailing and teach it to their kids. You know, the whole gun culture thing of going hunting with your dad and you take time off from school. There's a whole sort of world around it, which isn't necessarily about violence per se.
Yes, and you would have folks, even listening now, I would believe that say, hey, I was raised around guns and they were used for hunting, right? That's a rite of passage. That's also something that fathers and sons do together. And I'm from Oklahoma, right? So guns are just how we go about our days. Even those of us that don't have guns, we know that other folks do. And we know how much it means to have a firearm in this part of the country. So that was another thing that I had to actually work very hard about writing into the story, because I would kind of gloss over these things. And my editor, who is in Boston, would be like, wait, I need you to draw that out in crayon.
Oh, interesting.
And I'd be like, why? Because I'm not from there, right? We're all not from there. Like New York, you're not gonna have a gun in New York, gonna go to jail. You know what I mean? You know, y'all got Rockefeller laws. Like y'all don't play about this. And yet here, it's just what we do.
We're speaking to R.J. Young about his memoir, Let It Bang, A Young Black Man's Reluctant Odyssey into Guns. Odyssey is an interesting word there. Why is odyssey appropriate?
Because it's the journey. And also, I'm a Greek history. Yeah, I'm a Greek history nerd. Mm-hmm. I have Invictus and Aristeia and Mullen Labe tattooed on me, because the stories are that important to me, because, you know, Odysseus's story is so important to me. But the thing about this is Odysseus got to go home. You know, he got to go home. He battled a king. He won back his wife. He got back his kingdom. Yo, man, this journey changed my life. And home is different now, right? The way that I construe the world is different now. And going through the process of neophyte to master with a pistol changes the way that I view the world. I also think that that is something that I read into the Odyssey, because you don't view the world the same after you go through what he went through. You know, even going back to the Iliad, which sets this up, and we can go off into that, but we're not going to. Point is, it's a journey, and journeys change us.
Oh, we can go off onto it. We'll do part two later.
Hey, that's up.
We're talking to R.J. Young about his memoir, Let It Bang. So you really go face first into this. You go to a gun show to buy your first gun. What was it like to walk into that gun show? And why did you go to a gun show instead of going to a gun shop?
Well, hold tight. I didn't buy my first gun. Charles bought that gun.
Charles did, right.
Right. But I went to the gun show because that's what Charles said we were going to do. Because I went to him and said, I think I need to get a gun. We reached the point in this conversation where I'm stymied by not owning or using or firing, right? I'd done a ton of research and I'd done a ton of reading, and we had lots of conversations that kind of stopped there. And we ended up going to the gun show because that's what Charles said we should do. And that's how I end up at Wanamaker's, which is the world's largest gun show, and it's in my hometown. So it was also kind of a natural act. And in doing so, you know, I get to see all these things that I knew about, but I didn't know about.
Mm-hmm.
And those things are off-putting. I understand things like Confederate flags because I was raised in Mississippi as a very young child. And I understand the sentiment of heritage, not hate. I also would tell those folks, well, your heritage would have enslaved me. So I kept walking because I know what to do with that. But I don't know what to do with seeing a Nazi SS uniform on display, because I thought we all agreed that Nazis were bad. You know, I thought that that was something we all took to the heart. And then we would see other shirts and hear conversations that used racial epithets and invited this idea that either either I was going to be a criminal or I was going to be a problem. And I had to ask myself the very hard question of, do people really hate me like that? People I had never met, people that have never met me, people that would see me by the color of my skin and just assume I'm bad or that I'm dangerous. But also in the middle of that, my ex-wife's father-in-law wanted to buy me my first gun, because that's also something that fathers do for their sons here. You know, I happen to be an adult and I happen to want a Glock 26, which is a Babe Glock kit, and it fits in your pocket, because I wanted to go about this from a self-defense standpoint. But it was important to him that he got it for me, in the same way that I would think it would be important for a father to buy his 12-year-old a 22 rifle to go, you know, hunt the varmints. So I had all of those emotions going on at once.
And then you had the next step of emotions on page 47. You're sitting in the car, you're sitting in Charles's truck, you have the Glock, it's still in its box, it's on your lap, and then you write, "This was the next step. I was ready to become a responsible licensed gun owner. I needed to know what it meant to have a gun in my house and to have the audacity to carry it in public." Do you remember that first time that you had your gun and you had it in your hands and you decided, I'm gonna shoot this thing. I'm gonna shoot this gun.
Yeah, I do. I was in Charles's presence. I was in the presence of, my ex-wife and her brother. But I was also, I didn't know what I was supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Charles is the kind of guy, he just wants to see how you react. You know, this is a guy who knew that I was a mechanic and would ask me what I thought about a broken vehicle, and then would tell me, oh, okay, that's what the mechanic at the dealership told me. And I'd be like, this is a test? You know, that's just kind of how he moved through life. And I understand that, because that's valuable. It is valuable to know what someone will do and not what you think they're going to do. So in that manner, I was asked to just kind of go and shoot it. And I did not have the best experience with it. I was terrified of doing something wrong, because I believe most folks who have never shot a firearm, who are shooting one for the first time as an adult, can also think, you know, if something goes wrong, I could shoot somebody and they could die. And that's bad. I go to jail, right? And it's a fear. It's not entirely rational, but that doesn't matter. And that's where I was. I was anxious. You know, I was anxiety riddled, because I didn't have any practice with this, and I was practicing for the first time. I was shooting for the first time. So nerves, I think, is the feeling that I had, just intense nerves.
It's interesting that you should say that, because you strike me, you obviously are somebody who studies a lot and you think about things a lot and you go deep into things a lot. And I'm not sure you can study like what it feels like to have a gun and shoot a gun. That's pure like emotion. That's just pure reality right in your hand. There's not a book about what that feels like.
Which is exactly the reason why I needed to own one and fire one, right? And I think you could say that about almost anything. You know, like we back to football, you don't know what it's like to get hit until you get hit. You know, you can read about it, you can hear what other people have to say about it, but your own experience is the most important.
As you were writing the book, and we're talking to R.J. Young about his new book, Let It Bang, A Young Black Man's Reluctant Odyssey into Guns, Chapter 8 says White NRA and Chapter 9 says Black NRA. And you did a lot of research into the history of the NRA and sort of how it evolved and morphed. But can you explain the Black NRA?
The Black NRA is the National African American Gun Association. I just call it NAGA. They're based out of Atlanta, Georgia. They were founded in 2015, and then with the advent of the 2016 election, their membership exploded, and they are opening new chapters even now as we speak. But these are folks who are mostly black, right? They don't discriminate. They'll let whoever in wants to be in good faith. They pay modest membership fees, but they also wanted to practice safety first and education of firearms without the political rhetoric that does not fit in with their reality of how they're construed in the world and how they walk through the world, right? And I draw that out with what I call the White NRA, which is basically the NRA, in the chapter preceding it, because it's very clear to me where I stand with the NRA. And I made that story clear with Philando Castile's, because that was a poster child, not just for black folks, but for what the NRA purports to stand for. This is a guy who had a handgun license. This is a guy who was following all the instructions. This is a guy that a police officer still shot and killed. And this was a perfect opportunity for the NRA to stand up and have his back and have his family's back. And not only did they not, they were late in their response and they were limp in their response. And knowing that, there's a lot of black folks that are like, you know, I can't really side with you guys on this, because you've shown that you don't care about what happens to me, even though we believe in many of the same ideals in regard to the Second Amendment and the right to carry.
Something else that was in the book that I don't say it made me chuckle, but I've talked to friends about gun control. This is just me as Allison talking to my friends. I say, you know, you get gun control. If a lot of brown and black people started buying guns, we'd have a lot of gun control. And that happened historically. And you go into that, what happened within the Black Power movement. Will you share that with folks?
Well, hey, man, Black Panther showed up to the state capitol in California with handguns, exercising their rights. And then all of a sudden, hey, we got to put a law in that prevents them from doing this, you know. And that was really, but even before that, right into the 19th century, there were laws that forbade African Americans from owning guns. And then with the advent of things like the Ku Klux Klan, you had people raiding your house for your firearms, so much so that Ida Wells wrote a really great pamphlet called Southern Horrors, outlining just why black folks should have guns to protect themselves, because it was becoming clear that the government was not going to protect them. And that carries into the next century and into the civil rights movement. And even now, there are folks like those in Naga who believe, yo, it happened once, it can happen again, I'm going to have mine.
We're talking to R.J. Young about his book, Let It Bang, A Young Black Man's Reluctant Odyssey into Guns. So you go through this whole process, you learn to shoot, you're understanding gun culture, you're researching it, and then you decide to become a certified instructor. Why did you make that decision?
Because I wanted to answer a fundamental question that was, I put a question mark on a statement. The statement is, a good guy with a gun is better than a bad guy with a gun. Now put a question mark at the end of that. How do you find out? Well, the best way for me to find out was to make myself a good guy with a gun, not just a good guy, but the best guy, a marksman. I wanted to be a Jedi master with a pistol. And the NRA certification was a way to reach that requirement, right? That is Yoda telling you, you know how to use the Force. So that's the reason why. And what did I learn? I learned that no, for me, a good guy with a gun is not better than a bad guy with a gun. In fact, it goes further. I'm a black man with a gun, and I'm a black man with 18 tattoos. I have locks. I wear Jordans. I wear jumper jeans. I wear loud clothes, right? I'm the guy that goes on PBS in a orange tank top, because that's how I go through life. Me having a gun on my person is not going to invite anybody to think that I'm a good guy. It's going to invite them to think that I have a gun on me. And with the recent incidents with not just black men, but young black boys who are unarmed, that are shot and killed by folks that are sworn to protect and serve them, nah, me carrying a gun ain't a good look, man. Even when I'm more qualified to carry one than most of the population.
There's a passage of hope in your book. It's on page 143. And, you know, I talked a little bit about silos at the beginning and people not crossing into each other's lives and cultures. And I think a lot of people right now think, I can't make a change. Nobody's changing their mind. But there was movement within your relationship with Charles and Charles' relationship with guns and what he thought about guns. Would you mind reading that passage on page 143 that starts with, "In our time together"?
Yes, ma'am. Where would you like me to end?
You can end where the funny part at the end of 144. Not funny, but, you know, punch your line.
All right. Just going to warn everybody, there's a lot of Oxford commas in here. And I'm not really into those. All right. In our time together, I believe Charles gained a greater understanding of what guns and gun ownership mean to me. He came to understand why it was more dangerous for me to carry a gun than it was for him, no matter how skilled and careful I am with one. I watched him engage with his friends in conversations about the shooting of unarmed black men in a way that is knowledgeable and forthright and built on the foundation of discussions he's had with me. He no longer wonders aloud if an unarmed black man deserved to be shot by police or if the unarmed black man was guilty of anything other than being in the wrong place at the wrong time. He's more critical of local law enforcement and its use of deadly force. He's empathetic and thoughtful about black communities' relationship with our fettered criminal justice system, and he has softened his stance on gun control. Over dinner one day, having seen his thinking slowly evolve, I told him I was proud of him. "Well, I care about my son-in-law," he said. This was before he became so angry with me that he stole my jar of change when he helped Lizzie move out. This was just a month before his daughter and I got divorced.
How do you feel that you changed somebody's mind?
Oh, it's not the change in the mind. It's that he was brave enough to continue to have the conversations with me. Because I think to change someone's mind is to say that you're going to, or to be proud that you are, I think is a bit arrogant. I really do. But I don't think it's so arrogant to ask people to continue to discuss with you what you will not be moved on and what they will not be moved on. That is what I'm most proud of, because that's very hard. That's extremely hard to do in any facet of life.
RJ Young, the name of the book is Let It Bang, A Young Man, Black Man's Reluctant Odyssey into Guns. RJ, it was a pleasure talking to you.
I appreciate you, Allison.
You're listening to WNYC.